You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Hi, my name is Jordan Lofthaus, and I'm a senior fellow with the Hayek Program at the Mercatus Center. Today's episode of the Hayek Program podcast is another part of a mini-series on economics and the environment. Today, I'm very excited to be chatting with two scholars working on a variety of topics in political economy and political philosophy. First, we have Pablo Paniagua, who's a professor in political economy at Universidad del Desarrollo and a research fellow at the Center for the Study of Governance and Society in the Department of Political Economy at King's College London. Pablo is also an affiliated scholar at the Ostrom Workshop at Indiana University Bloomington. And second, we have Vishan Rayamaji, who's an assistant professor in economics in the Department of Agribusiness and Applied Economics at North Dakota State University. He's also a faculty fellow at the Center for the Study of Public Choice and Private Enterprise and a faculty scholar at the Chaley Institute for Global Innovation and Growth at NDSU. So Pablo and Vishan have actually co-authored several papers together on ideas associated with the Bloomington School, including polycentricity, institutional analysis, common pool resources, co-production, and democratic self-governance. Most recently, they've co-authored a working paper with the Mercatus Center titled Governing the Global Fisheries Commons. So thank you so much, Pablo and Vishan, for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Jordan, for inviting us. We're very excited. It feels like since we write papers together and we have this together, it feels like we are like a very like a joint production in this podcast. So that's fun.
Yeah, definitely. So before we get into the specifics of your guys' research, particularly on global fisheries commons, I want to ask you more generally about the Bloomington School. From the Bloomington School, what do you see as the most important intellectual contributions? And how does the Bloomington School's approach to political economy differ from other schools of thought? I guess you could argue the Virginia School is probably the most closely associated, but I think they're important distinctions. How do you see those?
Well, you know, I mean, a little caveat, I think different people, the Bloomington School is such a broad, you know, encompasses a lot of studies, empirical studies, theoretical studies. So it's very difficult to pinpoint what is exactly, you know, their contribution. Obviously, it's very subjective in the interpretation. But for my take, what I've gathered for me is like three particular points, I would say. One is that they unravel the mechanics and the logics of collective action, like real world collective action. So in that way, they have fleshed out all this work of Manco Olson, but applied to like real world cases beyond theory. So I think the biggest contribution is to help us to understand the mechanics and the logics of how individuals work together, or they might not be working together. That leads, I think, to a second contribution, which is a focus on empirical cases. Usually, you know, most of like political economists are very like into like blackboard economics. So in a way, they also follow in a very Coasean theme, which is like, you know, let's see the real world, let's study the real world and how that works, and through those cases try to generalize or obtain insights into what things work and why they don't. And I think a third contribution is that they help us to provide a way of thinking about complex modern problems when clear-cut solutions are not a given or absent. Even probably, you know, optimal solutions are not absent. You know, economists tend to think of in binary terms and in optimal solution terms, and we get stuck into like, you know, it's either privatization, it's either, you know, sort of like government control stuff. So and they provide a more nuanced way of thinking about they're not panaceas, so there must be an arrangement of solutions that might be applied to. And so it's a less dogmatic approach to understand this complex problem, particularly in the 21st century where things are so intertwined that it seems that clear-cut solutions are ever more less present. And finally, I think that the ultimate conclusion that I gathered from them, and I think Vishan has really taken that to heart, is that the only way to doing interesting social sciences nowadays, given this complexity of the problems, is through embracing multi-methods, embracing different methods of approaching to deal with the problem or dealing with different aspects of the problem. So like, for instance, vision can talk, you know, field work, regressions, synthetic controls, lab experiments, case studies, analytical case studies, historical case studies. So you we embrace a very broad set of tools that we can use according to the complexity of the problem. And I think Bishan, even better than me, has taken that to heart in his work.
Pablo, thank you. I don't think I do it better than you do. I think you have a much more broader and you know, rigorous way of looking at various concepts. Anyways, I'll just follow up on most of the points. I think the things that I wanted to highlight, you've kind of explained it better than I would have. But perhaps there's value in repetition because, you know, we like polycentric way of thinking about things. So repetition itself is not really a problem. I think there will be, you know, even though there will be significant overlap, I think there will be some areas that I'll hopefully get to. Pablo mentioned the methodological aspect of the Bloomington School. I think one of their key strengths is that they're very methodologically eclectic, right? Instead of being dismissive to a particular approach because it's not rigorous enough or it's not generalizable and so on, I think the Bloomington School really takes all different methodological approaches seriously and appropriately, you know, puts them in the right places, right? Instead of being forceful about just one particular way of looking at, you know, answering a problem, I think they're much more inclusive of different methodological approach. And I think that lets them see things better, right? And one thing I want to point out before even jumping to the answer, I should have pointed out is both Pablo and I, we're not actually trained in the Bloomington School tradition. We're just, you know, always looking in from the outside. And I think there is a certain value in that. But I do feel like that's something that we should point out because we're not trained by, you know, scholars of the Bloomington tradition. We've all, of course, interacted with them on various capacities and so on. But that's something I think should be pointed out. Another thing, one of the things that you asked is how does it differ from, let's say, the Virginia School or other schools, right? And Pablo did talk about how, I mean, because it's such a broader, you know, school of thought, it's depending on where you look at, I think you see a lot of complementarities with different schools, but also you see a lot of tensions. So it's really hard to just come up with and say this is, in fact, where the schools differ. But I think the way I would think about it is economics in general and a lot of different competing schools of political economy, they tend to be, yes, they're rooted in methodological individualism, many of them, let's say Virginia School, right? But again, they're so committed to methodological individualism that sometimes I think they get trapped in it. I think Bloomington School has a way of reconciling a methodological individualism with different levels of analysis, right? I think, for example, thinking about the IAD framework, you can zoom in and zoom out, right? And there's a way to reconcile that. And from a very pragmatic point of view, of course, there's always going to be philosophical tensions when we try to zoom in and see the linkages between different levels. But I think because they're so pragmatic, right? It's the problem that is at the heart of their approach, right? They're trying to understand real world problems. And so I think that sort of approach really gives them flexibility to zoom in and zoom out and think about different levels and at the same time reconcile all these different levels. And I think that's key, right? And that's key to analyzing a lot of complex problems that we have to deal with in the 21st century, because if we are so stuck in just one way of looking at things, right? So it's a, you know, binocular view versus microscopic view, right? We can argue about if microscope's better than binocular, but, you know, I think that sort of debate oftentimes is unproductive, right? Because I think both are very important. We can debate about how these two interact and where the exact linkages are, but I think a lot of times that can be quite distracting. And so I think Bloomington School really is welcoming up all these different approaches to analyzing social phenomena. And I think that's what distinguishes it from many other schools. And Pablo also touched on, for instance, their empirical orientation. So it's not the of course, theory is very important. We're all economists. We look at things a certain way, right? There's an economic way of thinking. We are all big fans of it. But at the same time, I think there is, you know, the real world problems often challenge prevailing theories. And if theories are all we care about, this high level abstract theorizing, then that can sometimes limit us because problems are evolving. They're one step ahead of our theories. And so there's the need to recalibrate our theoretical lenses and our worldviews. And I think Bloomington School does an excellent job of just kind of reconciling all those tensions and the need for flexibilities and so on. So those are some of the areas I can think of. I'm not sure if we really got at the differences, but I think those are the things, the defining features of the Bloomington School that make it, distinguish it from many other schools.
Yeah, that's great. And it kind of reminds me too, well, at least in the way I see it, the Bloomington approach and the Virginia approach, again, they're very close. They come from like very similar intellectual traditions. I think like one example we could talk about where they're both similar and a little bit different is even just like their work on policing. From like, you know, the Virginia perspective, we can think of policing, we could think of, you know, the role of special interest groups, you know, rent seeking, how police unions might affect the way that policing is done in a city. We can use public choice economics from the Virginia School to analyze that. Which again, I don't think the Bloomington, like people in the Bloomington approach would say, no, that's wrong. I think they would say, yes, that's right. And then the Bloomington approach would be, okay, what institutional configuration do we use to best, you know, get policing? And obviously some of the early work from Vincent Ostrom and Eleanor Ostrom were on metropolitan policing and how it was these overlapping smaller level police departments, not the huge, like one giant police department. Actually, the lots of little ones actually ended up doing better and were more responsive to local needs. And so, yeah, I guess you can kind of pivot back and forth between like the Virginia approach, the Bloomington approach to get a more nuanced view of solving or like why social problems arise in the first place and what do we do about them?
I think that's true. It's a way of, you can use both to understand the problem. And I think perhaps maybe the Bloomington School is a little more creative in possible ways to find, you know, it's more like gray areas to solve the issue. But I think definitely both are very complementary in regards to like public policy, in regards to like, you know, the real world. I think both of them are good instruments to assess those.
I want to turn now to your recent paper governing the Global Fisheries Commons. And obviously, this is coming out of, you know, probably Eleanor Ostrom's most famous book, Governing the Commons. I'm wondering if you can, for our listeners, explain what you mean by Global Fisheries Commons and what you think we should do about this, you know, Earth-sized problem.
Yeah, well, it's a big problem. And I think I come from political economy. Vision comes from like more like development and disaster. So it wasn't really our focus of interest. But we're always like interested about complex problems. And so we got invited by Mercatus and other people to start thinking about environmental problems, in particular the fisheries. So we have a big problem in our world today into which fishes have become overfished and overconsumed because the current governance system of the oceans incentivizes, you know, this kind of like tragedy of the commons. So just to give you a little background, the world is divided into like, let's say, in two major regimes. One is like a special economic zones, EEZs, into which there are like 200 maritime miles away from, you know, land. And like governments and states have like a sovereignty into this area. So it's like, quote unquote, you know, they have property rights. But the other 48%, almost 50% of the oceans are nobody's land. They are like they pertain to the high seas sort of like system. So there's no enforceable property rights there, and that creates a big problem because since it's, you know, there are no property rights, you cannot exclude. So a lot of people go there to fish, movable resources. And the fishes are interesting because they're very challenging because they're movable resources. Evelyn Ostrom mentions them in a few times in her work. She didn't study them at depth, but she mentions that. So fishes have these two, the governance of fish have these two problems. Fish are movable resources. So for example, tuna can start its travels, you know, in the Mediterranean and then in the other part of the world. So they can be fished by a lot of different people, by a lot of different countries. And second of all, half of the world is have ill-defined property rights there, right? So one would assume, following Harding and all that logic, right, that they will get a lot of these fish will get overfished in the absence of property rights. And that's exactly what is going on in the world. Like, given the development of consumers that eats protein, and given the regime and given the movable resources of the fish, we have an overexploitation. We're consuming fish faster than they can be reproduced. And that obviously poses a lot of tensions, not only for fish itself, but for the entire ecosystem, because there are other fish that depend on other fish, and seafood that depends on other seafood, and other. So it's like a very nested problem into which if you destroy one, you know, population of fish, that can have repercussions into other ecosystems and to even local communities, you know, that depend on other things. So it's a very wicked problem, nested problem, if you want to call it. So we decided to call the paper The Challenges Governing the Fisheries Commons, because it in a way resembles a, you know, like the tragedy of the commons in regards to that. So our idea was to try and say, well, how can we deal with this problem where it has all these like particular institutional features?
Yeah, Pablo, that's great. And I'll try to, because he explained the problem so well, I'll just try to get to what we argue or what our focus is on the paper, the way we look at the problem itself. So I think, again, going back to the some of the tenets of the Bloomington School, we view the problem itself as an analytical entry point, right? This is where we begin our analysis. It's not, for example, the you know, economist's way of looking at the fisheries problem. We kind of have, you know, the Scott Gordon model from the 1960s, which is basically kind of simplifying the problem and appropriately, right? Because as a beginning point of analysis, I think economists, you know, we do simplify problems so that it's tractable, right? But at the same time, the real world fishery is much more complex than what we kind of model in a just, you know, abstractly. And so it's not that we're emphasizing an atheoretical approach, but rather taking theories seriously, but appropriately situating them within the reality, right? The empirical reality of the world. And so, for example, I think one of the problems that we encountered when we were trying to just look at the fisheries problems from this narrow, let's say, optimizing problem point of view is that there's an aggregation problem that's going on for two reasons, right? So first, I mean, as analysts and scholars, we want the problem to be tractable. So we want to define it and give it a fixed level, right? And then we don't really question the nestedness and the complexities that are embedded within the system. And that is because we want to understand the problem. So we want to simplify it, right? So there's that one temptation. But also from a policy usefulness point of view, policymakers have an incentive to, you know, simplify and aggregate the problem in a way that they feel empowered to act upon, right? Because if we focus too much on the complexities, it's not quite sure what is the appropriate level at which they can intervene and act, right? And so for these two reasons, I think there is sort of a weird equilibrium where analysts and policymakers both are incentivized to assume a fixed static level. But when we take a problem such as the global fisheries, yes, it's global in a sense that it's aggregated to the global and it's widespread globally. But when you look at the intricacies of the problems, they're spread out. They're, you know, in various levels, various jurisdictions and non-jurisdictions, right, especially in the high seas. And so they become much more complex. And it's, even though they're global, they're not really a one monolithic problem. They're thousands of different problems. They've just been aggregated to these global fisheries problems by analysts and by policymakers because, again, to self-empower themselves, right, to fulfill their particular objectives. And so our approach, again, this is, again, following Eleanor Ostrom's fantastic paper in 2009, where I'm trying to, I think, Jordan, you yourself cited that and found inspiration in that paper, where they try to think of this global climate change problem, right? So it's, again, very similar theme kind of motivates our approach as well, where it's not really, yes, we have come to understand this as one problem, but when you look at the intricacies of this, this is not one problem. This is thousands of different problems, right? And it's aggregated to that particular level for our own convenience. Not necessarily because the problems are that way and not because the problems are solvable by aggregating it that way, right? And so what we try to argue is that it's not just one problem. Yes, it is a global problem, but it's many heterogeneous problems at different levels, and the problems are not limited to certain jurisdictions. They go back and forth. The different jurisdictions have to come together to solve a lot of these problems, especially if you think about the high seas. It's, you know, there's no governing authority there. And when we even think about, let's say, you know, from the Bloomington tradition, there's a lot of emphasis on self-governance. But what does self-governance even mean when we're talking about the high seas? It's not like there are communities and people living there, right? So it becomes particularly problematic. But anyways, our emphasis there is really, let's try to look at the intricacies of the problems and let's try to think about different solutions that do exist, right? Instead of just saying, okay, it's a global problem, there's no solution, that the only way we can solve it is to by collectivizing it. But we already do collectivize it, right? And the problem is that collectivization is, we can theoretically collectivize it, but the empirical reality is there's a host of governance issues associated with that, right? So instead of being cynical about potential solutions, how can we appropriately situate a variety of solutions that already do exist and then kind of come up with a portfolio of solutions and maybe tackle different problems at different levels? And where aggregation is necessary, we can aggregate at those levels. Where aggregation leads to more collective action problems, we can perhaps, you know, disaggregate those kinds of problems, right? And so that's kind of how we've thought about the global fisheries problem. It's perhaps, you know, again, yeah, that we paid tribute to governing the commons by Eleanor Ostrom. But I think the problem here is, in fact, more severe than a lot of the CPR problems that, you know, that are included in governing the commons. And Pablo did mention, for instance, the fugitive nature of the fisheries system that make it kind of tricky, right? And I think that is also kind of at the heart of this problem. There are different species of fish, and they all interact. They're all part of the, you know, marine ecosystem. And our economic way of thinking about the problem, we treat them as one entity, right? And you know, this is one of the criticisms that a lot of, you know, non-economists, you know, in the biological sciences and so on, throw at economists, right? We simplify things. And I think that's a very valid criticism. We do very much simplify it. And perhaps we're so, again, obsessed with our methodological tools that even when they're not necessarily appropriate, we want them to be appropriate. And so I think it is one of those cases where perhaps the de facto, the default tools that we have in economics isn't quite the best. I think there's a place for it, but we have to understand and acknowledge where that place is, right? I think a lot of tools and perspectives provided by the Bloomington School lets us do that. And I think, I don't want to say we have that quite figured out, but I think that's the right direction to think about the global fisheries problem.
And also, I think it's a way of thinking in environmental problems in general, especially in you know, interconnected worlds. I think this way of thinking, there is not a unitary problem, but rather layers of different problems that need to be tackled at different scales with different tools, right? So in some instances, individual transfer of quotas or private property rights will do the trick. In other parts of the world into which, you know, property rights probably are not enforceable, that's not the right solution. So you need to like empower local communities to have other more informal forms of property rights to deal with their own marine resources, right? So the conclusion, again, goes back to the first question. That's the insight of the ocean. It's like, it's not a unitary problem, but a layered problem that leads to the conclusion that there's no one single silver bullet solution, but rather we need to, and that makes it very practical and pragmatic, you know, right? We need to figure out really, it's not about, you know, who's right or who's wrong, if privatization is the right choice or not. It's rather, the question is rather, which solution should be allocated into which scales or which approach should be approached to which scale in order to deal with that aspect of the problem, that fragment. And hopefully a solution will emerge from the whole, right? Obviously, you know, this compressed problem probably don't even have an optimal solution, but the idea is to mitigate. You know, we live in a non-ideal world. So rather, we're not arguing for solving the problem. I think a lot of environmental problems cannot be solved, but they can be ameliorated. But I think a first step toward ameliorating these problems, and your work, Jordan, I think points in that direction as well, right, is rather thinking about which aspects of the problem we need to tackle with which institutions, right?
Yeah. And as both of you were talking, it made me think of a few things. With the oversimplification where we like treat all fish as like the same problem when there are like many, many types of fish, some are highly mobile and travel thousands of miles through the ocean. It reminds me of a passage from Governing the Commons towards the beginning where Eleanor Ostrom talks about how theories and models are purposefully abstractions from the real world. And theories and models can actually be misleading when we use them as reality for making public policies. And I'm not who was the original person to say this, but you know, there's the phrase that all models are wrong, but some models are useful. And so I think that's what we can, you know, that's kind of an insight from economics and political economy is there are a lot of these models that can be useful, but we have to realize the real world is so much more complicated than that. And like both of you were saying, these nested problems at different scales and scopes, it gets really messy really quickly.
I 100% agree. And you said it very well. Yeah, thank you. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah. And then another thing that you were saying that maybe you think is, I guess we can kind of divide the problems with fisheries into two general categories. Like Pablo was saying, there's the side where there's the EEZs, the exclusive economic zones, where policy is super important. And I think we can see in different places, even within the same country, you can see different management regimes for different types of fish or different fish in different places. And so we can compare and contrast, you know, like, oh, this one worked really well here, and that one worked really, you know, poorly there. You know, even though there's policies, it still got overfished and the fishery collapsed. I think we've seen that in a bunch of places, even in, you know, highly technocratic Western democracies, the US, Canada, other places have had huge fishery collapses. But then, yeah, the high seas seems like that's a completely separate category because policy there can't do a lot, obviously, because there's no one government with jurisdiction. Of course, there are treaties and things between countries, but not much that can be done. So this is where I want to turn to the idea of polycentricity. In your paper, you talk a bit about polycentricity and how it can solve environmental problems or other social problems. How do you guys think about polycentric solutions to these really tricky problems, either in EEZs or in the high seas? Like, what does polycentricity actually do? The reason I say this is a lot of people, including myself, who like the Bloomington School, are persuaded by it, really like the idea of polycentricity. But then we can also sometimes say, oh, you know, slap some polycentricity on it and it'll solve the problem. But like you said, the complexity is such a huge issue. What does polycentricity really look like? What do polycentric solutions actually mean in the context of such a huge, difficult problem like global fisheries?
Yeah, well, I think as you were saying, I think more than polycentricity being the solution, polycentricity is like the framework into which we're trying to figure out which solutions might be according to the level of the scale of the problem. So it's more like a way of thinking, it's like a framework of thinking to start looking for solutions rather than the solution alone. And obviously the solution will resemble some sort of like polycentricity in the sense that it will encompass different organizations at different levels. And I think one of like, usually a lot of like people that come, you know, from a more like classical liberal world or from the Virginia School will tend to like be dismissive of like, you know, the top down or like the big power aspect of the solution. But I think in polycentric terms, there's a role for that as well, you know, like especially in large scale problems. Like for example, in the pandemic, like in climate change problems, right? There is a role from the top down, from the bottom up, local communities to solve certain aspects of the problem. But at certain levels of coordination, particularly in the high seas, right? You need some higher level structure or some higher level coordinating mechanism that can, you know, deal with this problem from the top down and can to help us dismantle the problem or help to coordinate how to we can solve the high seas problem. And particularly, so I think this is an invitation to think more in pragmatic terms. And I think, for example, I find the fisheries problem very analogous to the climate change problem. And I really like this piece by Nobel Prize winner Nordhaus in American Economic Review, like 2010 or something. He advocates for like this club, for a climate club that is attached to international commercial treaties. So I think that could be part of the solution to climate change, not the only, you know, part of the solution, but definitely there's a role for this like higher up governmental organizations to play a positive role. And I think, for example, thinking in terms of clubs, which is very Buchananite in its own way, if you think about clubbing or coordinating to make agreements more enforceable at the top might also contribute to find collective solutions or like state-led solutions to the high seas, whereas you can always also find private-based solutions and property rights-based solutions to the EECs or more local, you know, aspects of the problem. So I think there's a role, you know, for like private property, there's a role for ITQs, there's a role for markets, the role for like, you know, well-defined property rights, but there's also roles for local communities, and there's also roles for big governments or like states that try to like, you know, solve the high seas. So the approach should be more pragmatic, and obviously this solution will look very patchy and very probably inefficient, or maybe might not even be a complete solution. But I think in this world of this nestedness and this complexity is the only way into which we can actually achieve some decent level of management of these problems.
So, yeah, thank you, Pablo. That's very, very well said. So some of the things that I wanted to add. So number one, I think we need to distinguish between polycentricity as an analytical framework and advocating for a polycentric governance, right? I think those two are often conflated, but those are very separate things, right? Of course, you know, the Ostroms, the Bloomington scholars have a commitment to polycentricity, but I think there is a lot of variation in terms of how, whether or not we should advocate for polycentricity as a solution, right? Again, they're very interesting papers. And one of the tenets of, again, polycentric way of looking at things is that there are no panaceas. But a lot of times there's also a risk of, you know, slapping polycentricity as the panacea, right? And I think we should avoid that kind of temptation. But rather, I think in this paper, what we try to do is take polycentricity as an analytical tool, right? To think through the problem, rather than to say, these are the polycentric solutions, this is what you should do, right? And in a way, you know, if you think about polycentricity seriously, all functional regimes are polycentric, and that includes functioning dictatorships. In fact, dictatorships that are highly monocentric break, right? There's no flexibility. It's all centered on one person, and someone can stab that person and it's over, right? Functioning polycentricity are again, there's enough duplicity and enough division of power. Yes, there is a commitment to monocentric authority. There's that ideological commitment, but nonetheless, the structure is quite polycentric. And our view in this paper is, yes, you know, there are all these international organizations trying to govern these, quote, global problems. But nonetheless, what we're trying to argue is not necessarily that, okay, you should abandon all these approaches that we've been trying, right? It's not that at all. In fact, it's not to even decentralize, because decentralization may not be the way in some cases, right? We do need some high-level solutions. So we don't necessarily say, okay, that's not polycentric enough, we should abandon those. But they have an appropriate place, right? They're highly inappropriate to govern a local fisheries, let's say it is tiny lake with 20 households governing it successfully. There's no need to centralize that, right? So that would be an area where globalizing the problem would be harmful, right? But there are areas, for example, in the high seas that may require some level of collectivization on how we think about solving those problems. It's not necessarily even establishing property rights. Again, the nature of the problem itself imposes problems in doing that, right? So we can't really say, okay, this fisheries in this particular location, you know, now we assign property rights to this farm A or community B and so on, right? That's just not practical. So anyways, so your second part of your question was, what exactly, how does polycentricity exactly come into play? What do we mean by that? And what are the types of solutions? And I think in that, I would take a, not trying to evade the question at all, but I think I'll try to refrain from saying this is exactly what ought to be done, because I think the approach that we take is more of a polycentric way of thinking about the problem rather than polycentricity as a solution, right? So the answers there are going to be deliberately very vague. And so one of the things I think we have to be very open about technological innovations, how we can use technology to map the problem, right? So one of the big problems that's at the heart of, you know, the governing challenge related to global fisheries is that we can't really track them, right? They move around and they interact with different species and, of course, the local communities, depending on where they are. So there's a lot of that dynamism there. But technology helps us at least map them out, right? So we have to be optimistic from that point of view and try to be open about how we can implement various technological innovations, various ways of harnessing all this data that now we've, you know, become so good at gathering, right? And of course, that interacts with various institutions and should be open to, you know, private solutions, but also public institutional solutions, right? Should be open about, you know, what are the problems, how large, what's the scale of the problem, what's the appropriate scale of the problem, and what's the appropriate scale of governing the problem? Are we trying to globalize a problem that could be better solved at, you know, let's say a community level, or is it the vice versa? Are we imposing more burden onto the community when the problems are, let's say, global? It has nothing to do with the local community, right? So I think it's about really going to individual problems and mapping them to appropriate level. And one way, you know, kind of broadly thinking about framing the problem and the solution is, again, how can we allow for experimentations in various pockets? And if there are lessons to be learned from those experimentations, how can we borrow insights from some of the successful experiments, right? And how can we limit the failed experiments from being harmfully replicated, right? So some of the things that a local community may do or a local jurisdiction may do may not work, and that may be actually harmful, but then we want to contain those, right? We want to make sure the negative externalities aren't, you know, flowing to other jurisdictions. So it's again a lot of trial and error and just kind of containing negative externalities within the narrow pockets, but also making sure that if there are positive lessons to be learned and there are positive externalities, how do we make sure they can be replicated and you know, spread out, you know, to wherever it's applicable, right? So that's kind of how we've thought about the problem. And again, I do apologize, we don't really have specific, this is what needs to be done. In fact, we're, again, not even arguing for decentralization or collectivization at all. We are kind of neutral about that, at least in the paper.
Yeah, no, that's great. It makes total sense, because I think if you're really taking the Bloomington School's insights seriously, one of the biggest things is intellectual humility. You aren't like, we don't want to be the, you know, policymakers or academics in the ivory tower looking down and knowing exactly how to solve every problem, because it's those far removed people that often don't have the local knowledge to know, well, they don't have the local environmental knowledge, they don't have the local social cultural knowledge that's necessary to solve these complex problems. One thing that I came up based on that, and then Pablo brought up the idea of an ITQ, and I think this is a really interesting way of looking at a potential polycentric solution. So an ITQ is, if I'm not mistaken, individual transferable quota, which essentially serves as a cap and trade for fish, which sounds kind of silly at first, but that's what it is the, you know, within the EEZ, a government says, okay, this is as many fish as can be, you know, taken out, and they give fishermen, you know, a certain quota they can catch, And then the fishermen can actually trade those pseudo property rights with one another. So we have this kind of market-like regulation, which in that sense is kind of polycentric. But then we also have different types of ITQs. We have different ITQs in different places. So we can say, well, we can look and see, and, you know, like Vishan was just saying, compare and contrast how well different ITQ systems actually work. Are you guys aware of any other kind of cool innovations in either the policy sphere that we're seeing with that, or even in like the commercial or community spheres of, you know, new ways of solving these collective action problems with fish?
Yeah, I mean, what you mentioned, ITQs, I think they're also like individual vessel quotas. You can establish, you know, quotas and property rights on vessels to like limit the amount of vessels that can be in an area. And I think this is an interesting way of thinking because, as Vishan said, you know, we're not committed to a single solution because technologies might also alter the solution, right? For example, like, you know, with nanotechnologies and microchips and stuff, maybe we can start, you know, putting nanotechnologies in fish, and in less than 20 years, 30 years, might be able to track live almost all the fish stocks in the ocean, and we can establish individual transfer quotas across the globe, and we can expand, you know, property rights in order to solve the problem. At the moment, you know, there's technologies working on that, but at the moment, obviously, that cannot be done. So obviously, in our, you know, near future, maybe that might not be the solution, but it might be, you know, 20 years from now or 10, 15 years from now. So one of the cool things about thinking in this Australian way is that the right solution is context and technologically dependent. For example, you know, swimming pools used to be, you know, club goods, but now with plastics, it's so cheap now we can have private pools, right? Cinemas were club goods, and now everybody has their own computer, you know, and use Netflix and stuff. So technology alters, you know, how goods are and the solution to deal with those goods. And I think technology in might help us eventually to come with more like, you know, private based or like property rights based solution to the problem, given the mobility and the dynamic of the fish, because that's the main problem. The governance problem is that a lot of fish just like move around property zones. So, but I think we in this paper, we do think that individual transfers, quotas, and property rights, insofar as they can be assigned, are a big part of the solution. But, you know, with a caveat that, you know, it's not the only part of the solution, but hopefully with technological advancements, it might be a big part of it, especially now with satellite, particularly we were asking about technologies, satellite innovations now enable us to track, you know, movements of vessels or heats of vessels, and we can almost like live track where our vessels moving. So eventually, if we can have like, you know, traceable devices on vessels assigned to, you know, property rights, we can have individual vessel quotas, and we can monitor those individual vessel quotas through satellite information and heat movement and stuff. And that will definitely help us to, you know, govern the commons area of the high seas, because the problem of the high seas is that it's a commons and we have a difficulty of exclusion. But if you can use technologies in vessels, you can exclude them, you know, you can even shut them down from the satellite eventually, you know, once they are out there. So I think technology will help us in maybe in regards to the fish itself, or maybe in regards to the vessels that are being used, in order to either create property rights or either create more efficient ways of excluding and monitoring, which again are the levers that the Ostrom School you always like pinpoint. You need to focus on these kind of things, and hopefully technology will help us to move in that direction to make it a big part of the solution.
Yeah, thank you, Pablo. I think to your question, Jordan, about, you know, are there successful experimentations and efforts out there that, you know, I think that question. So there's a lot of literature, right? So Ostrom herself has covered quite a bit of ground in this particular topic. I mean, there's lots and lots of cases where, you know, they have been successfully governed, lots of cases where they haven't, right? One very interesting paper that I can think of is from the 1990s. I think Adela Schlager and Ostrom have this piece in Land Economics where, you know, analyzing main lobster fishery, right? So how geography can complicate the problem. And of course, we've emphasized so far as, you know, that technology can be part of the solution. But that paper is important in that it reminds us that technology can also further complicate the problem, right? So there's a lot of interaction between technology and institutions. And so that can lead us to newer challenges, right? They can give us new challenges and, of course, equip us with tools to be able to address some of those, but at the same time, you know, complicate challenges as well. So with regards to, you know, what exact solutions there are, I think ITQ, there's a lot of variation. Yes, I think there's a temptation to say it's one of the solutions, but really ITQ, there's a lot of different kinds of them, right? Different ways they have been implemented. Somewhere they have been successful, in others they haven't been. So these are really, again, when we say, you know, ITQ or collectivizing at the common pool resource CPR level, right? These aren't just one solution. There's a whole lot of diversity. There are successful CPR governing institutions, but there are also a whole lot of them that aren't successful, right? And even, you know, technological solutions. I mean, a lot of times we can harness data and technology to track individual species, to track a different fishery system, but they can also empower those trying to exploit the resource system. They're all of a sudden empowered, right? And in fact, technology is at the heart of the problem too. So, you know, when we weren't able to go to the high seas beyond a certain level and exploit all these resources, the problem wasn't as pervasive. It was limited to certain areas where people could go, right? So technology itself has been the part of the problem. So we have to sort of acknowledge that as we try to think about technology as potential solution, right? So anyway, so I think to directly answer your question, I think there are lots of ITQs, different models of them. There are different models of regulatory approaches as well. And some have been successful in kind of appropriately aligning incentives at different levels. Some have been just kind of forced onto the people and local communities in the shores, right? And they have been exploitative and unsuccessful. So there's a lot of diversity in the types of institutions and the types of solutions that have been adopted. Even when we think about, you know, property rights and letting private entrepreneurs innovate and so on, there's a lot of variety in how that's done.
I think a bit, just jumping on vision, there's also like a very Hayekian message in that, in the sense that sometimes we have limits of what we can know, right? For example, is the debate of whether we can either we should close the high seas completely or we should privatize the seas entirely, and different very similar models with very similar assumptions end up in entirely different public policy solutions. But we don't really know. We don't really know. Maybe closing the high seas might be the best solution, but maybe it might be the worst solution. But given the state of the complexity of the nestedness of the environmental problems, it's very difficult ex ante to know which one is the likely solution to work. And it's, I think, especially in environment and other complex externalities, I think that Hayekian message needs to be taken to heart, that we know we have a different plethora of solutions. And even, you know, with very similar models, we might end up with promoting different solutions, but we don't know which one actually will work. And that's, in a way, it's terrifying, but we should acknowledge that limitation into which you know the right solution would be.
Yeah, and another thing that I wanted to add, you have to also kind of think about, you know, why the problem persists. It's ultimately consumers who want fish, right? So without that demand, the problem wouldn't even exist. So because there's a vibrant market for that, there's a high demand. So that's kind of motivating exploitation of this fishery system. So we can't forget that, you know, consumer awareness and, you know, making sure that information is available out there, that's also part of the solution. Like, we can't just think about, you know, solving the problem from the supply side. I think there's a demand side that we need to also consider.
Yeah, that's really interesting too. And I think if we're talking about, you know, both a polycentric analysis of a problem and potential polycentric solutions, like Vishan, you outlined before, at least on the solution side, if we take the demand issues into context, I think You can have civil society groups, nonprofit organizations bringing awareness to consumers.
Yeah.
Like you can say like, oh, this was, you know, sustainably fished or not sustainably fished. We might, I mean, you could even talk about markets and how in the future we might have 3D printed fish. I don't even know, something like that, where we don't even have to worry about fishing real fish out of the ocean anymore. We can just eat, you know, fish equivalent that has been 3D printed, you know, Beyond Meat and all these like new meat substitutes or things like that.
Yeah, there's a good example of the role of the private sector with the Chilean sea bass. In the 90s and the 80s, the Chilean sea bass became very popular in the United States. And, you know, US consumers thought it was like a very good fish and very elegant. It was like in restaurants and stuff. So the demand went skyrocket, and it almost, the consumption almost collapsed the production of the Chilean sea bass and almost went extinct. And a big role was played by Whole Foods and other supermarkets that said that we're not going to sell this fish anymore because otherwise we're going to depredate it. And consumers got away from that. Thanks to the private sector, consumers stopped demanding that, given, you know, it became aware of the problem thanks to also to you know, profit-seeking firms. So I think there's a role. Usually, you know, supermarkets and the private sector gets demonized, right? Particularly in environmental problems. But I think there's also, they can really play a positive role. If they can spin correctly, they can, you know, be ahead of the game and help us, you know, flag different fishes that might be, you know, problematic to consume, and hence, you know, become consumers more aware of avoiding those in order to avoid the depletion of those resources.
Yeah. And so I kind of want to zoom back. So we've talked about, you know, fisheries for a while now, but I want to zoom back a little further to environmental problems in general. And I know both of you have written in the past on the idea of externalities, particularly, you know, negative environmental externalities. So in kind of like the biggest way possible, how should we think about the nature and structure of externalities? And what does that mean for solving environmental problems? So we've already talked about climate change a little bit. I mean, climate change is rooted in a negative externality, like Vishan was talking about before, talking about, you know, externalities of both overfishing and the potential policies that we do. These policies can actually have negative externalities. Water pollution, air pollution, or externality problems. I mean, the list goes on and on. So yeah, I'd like to hear kind of your guys' take on what externalities are, how do we deal with them?
Yeah, I think that paper was born, at least from my side, but Vishan can explain his side. I felt like sometimes kind of like unease in the way that a lot of people treat externalities, that especially like if you go with like a extreme subjectivist economic view on externalities, like if you take like Buchanan's subjectivism, like full core to the bottom, people will say like, externalities are just subjective. And if they're there, they're going to be solved. If they're not there, just individuals are not going to solve them. So it's like a very like nihilistic way of thinking about externalities, particularly large ones. And I thought that way of thinking about big problems is kind of like counterproducing, that it doesn't get us anywhere. So I felt like unease with that take of like, you know, because it's kind of like an easy, cheap way of like negating the existence of those problems. Is it like, if the problem will be there, you know, Kosian or Buchananite solution will be emerge. Otherwise, it's not worth the cost of addressing them, right? And I felt kind of unease with that take. So in what we're trying to do in this paper is classifying externalities into four different categories, basically, broadly. Ones that are very like subjective based and easily solvable or like not worth addressing. So for example, think of like a smelly passenger in the subway, or like somebody that is making a lot of noise in the bus, right? You might, you know, step in and say, can you lower, you know, the volume of your music? He might be violent, you know, she might be violent, or, you know, a struggle might appear and you don't want to get involved into that, right? So in those scenarios, you just, that we call it the suck it up externality. Like the cost is just not worth addressing, right? So it's like, it's 5 minutes, 10 minutes ride in the bus. You don't want to risk, you know, get into a fight. You're just like, I'm going to just like suck it up because the benefits might be below the cost. And I think in that realm of very small self-contained externalities, that Buchananite approach of thinking, I think applies pretty well. right? And there are other externalities that we call it more like coaching style, into which you can create property rights, right? And allow people to trade, and coaching bargaining will emerge, and the externality will be internalized by the, you know, invested parties through these exchanges. But again, I feel that in bigger, large problems, we have very difficult problems in assigning property rights, right? We talk about fish and how difficult it is at the moment to assign property rights. So I also feel that that's part of the solution, but not the entire solution, right? So there's also this coastal externalities, but property rights are limited to that. So, and so there's another part of the framework, there's other realm of externalities that cannot be addressed, should be addressed, but we cannot, you know, just suck it up, otherwise we're going to be dead, right? And we cannot use property rights because it's very difficult to assign property rights to, like, you know, gas emissions and stuff. So in those problems, is that we call it this nested externalities. And I think this category of externalities are very different from the other ones. And I feel like most people that follow the Virginia school of thinking haven't been thinking in those nested externalities, and they assume that all externalities are alike, when reality externalities are very different. You have the suck it up externalities, the causing externalities, and these all other nested ones that are more tricky to address. And climate change, I think, is like the epitome, you know, pandemics are also the epitome of that. So that paper was an attempt to classify the externalities according to these difficulties of assigning property rights, into point away of being less nihilistic and more, you know, positive about acknowledging their existence and they need to be addressed, and hopefully paving a way forward into like a more constructive thinking about them. I don't know what you think, Vision.
I mean, I think you did a fantastic job. I'm not even sure what else I can add. But what I do want to emphasize is that what we try to do in the paper is also think through, first of all, the scale of the problem itself. So the scale is a very important factor. And this is something, you know, both Eleanor Ostrom and James Buchanan have talked about quite extensively, right? The scale is a crucial factor. The externalities that span across the globe are very different than externalities that are, you know, containable, right? That we can package in a, you know, within at an individual level or at a local level. So those, even though they might have very similar, let's say, physical properties, the scale will remain an important consideration. So we take that into heart, right? So we think that's an important consideration, but at the same time, it also interacts with the institutions, right? So some, again, we talked about property rights and so on, but there's also a regulatory component to that. So so there are different types of institutions and different types of solutions that can be applied and are applied, but then there is also the scale, and these two aspects interact, right? And then they create their own set of complicated configurations, and we have to take those into account. So even large scale problems, depending on the institutions that are in place, they can be quite different. So you can have a large scale externality problem that can be taken care of by the private sector quite easily, right? So some of the examples that we've in various versions, the paper has gone through various iterations. So in one of the versions, we talked about, you know, computer viruses that can be, someone can create that in one country in South Asia, and then it could spread out throughout the globe. But that, again, even though it's a global kind of problem, the solution can be an antivirus software, right? It's a very simple private kind of solution. Whereas other problems can be global scale, and we don't have that kind of, you know, easy private solution, may require some kind of collectivization. But at the same time, we have to be, you know, keep in mind that collectivizing itself incorporates significant cost, right? So Buchanan and Tulloch, for instance, talk about the cost approach to thinking about externalities, right? The cost cannot be ignored, right? It just because the problem is serious enough doesn't mean it has to have a solution. If the costs of the solutions are more than the problems themselves, then it's, you know, quote, not worth addressing. But again, we run into this problem where even though we understand that these are problems not worth addressing from just a purely economic point of view, that there's going to be a significant political push towards addressing them. Right? And those are a separate category of problems that we can't do. We just can't ignore, even though from an economic point of view, they are, you know, not worth solving. Right. We can think of many different problems that fall into that category. So there's enough collective will that those are going to remain relevant. Right. And so for that, I think the only way we can deal with those kinds of problems are how do we resolve some of the collective action problems associated with that. And Pablo earlier talked about different types of goods, right? So maybe they're in this realm where they're, you know, the problem's too nested and we can't really, grapple with them. So maybe we can unbundle and sort of, you know, disaggregate the problem and put them in separate other kind of categories. Maybe part of the problem can be solved by assigning property rights. Maybe the problem will require, let's say, some sort of regulatory approach, right? So kind of unbundling these complex, bigger, large scale problems and trying to solve them in many ways possible, right? So the ultimate polycentric way of thinking about the problem.
So just to clarify, what we wanted to in the externality work, we were trying to follow this kind of the Ostrom and Ostrom had this, you know, the famous matrix of like goods, private goods, club goods, CPRs, and the other ones. So we wanted to like kind of like mimic that approach of like categorizing goods into externalities, something that hasn't been done. And the two parameters that determine the properties of externalities are hold definable. Our property rights and the scale of the problem. So those two variables, the how cohesive to create property rights and negotiate, and the scale in the largeness or impactness of the externality are the two variables that are going to determine where we're going to classify, how we're going to classify them. So is we're following like very similar way of like Vincent and Eleanor were thinking in their classification of goods, in order to like kind of like enrich the conversation of externalities. And this relates with this nested problems that we're saying, because this one quadrant, this one of the fourth, that is really like very complex, as Vishen was saying, that actually requires not one single solution, but rather different solutions at different scales, right? Think of the pandemic, right? The pandemic is a massive viral externality. We maybe going out without a mask might create externalities to others, right, and so forth. But the problem should be addressed at very different scales, at the school level, at the private sector level, at the personal level, at the family level, at the international level, right? Countries, for example, right, remember, they closed the borders, or some others they didn't. So the problem needs to be tackled at many different levels in order to be managed correctly. Schools might be transitioning to digital. That's, you know, helping to the solution. Civil society can help to enforce it, the norms, right? Like washing your hands, or, you know, trying to like have meetings in outdoor places rather than indoor places, and so forth. And those are part of the solution. They shouldn't be disregarded, right? And economists just think of only one solution. You know, like just like close all the countries and close everything down, like a very like a lockdown kind of like approach. And we rather say that the best way to deal with these externalities is actually acknowledging that different parts of the society needs to play key roles in the co-production of the solution at different levels. And that's one of the externalities that we were in this matrix, one of the realms of the externalities.
Yeah, that sounds great. I think that is a perfect place to end our conversation today. So I want to thank you both very much for your time. And it was great to talk to you.
And yeah, I hope you guys enjoy our job. And we really enjoy your work too. So it has been a cross-fertilization of ideas. So we're very happy to be invited by Mercatus. And hopefully you can invite us soon again.
Yes, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.